General Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session.
Pursuant to adjournment. Good morning, be seated, please.
To adjourn us before we start.
First case on our calendar is 96-1213, State of Ohio versus Dennis McGuire. Ms. Leonard. Watch your time on the clock.
At the time of the killing?
Well, there was evidence that on February 11th, the day of George's disappearance, that yes, he was at work.
So he has an airtight alibi.
I'm sorry,
he's
well,
got an airtight alibi.
Not exactly, Your Honor. He checked in at 7 a.m. and he checked out at 5 p.m. Between those hours, he was essentially on his own and unsupervised. So therefore, he did have an opportunity to have committed this crime. His evidence was central to Mr. McGuire's defense.
But McGuire goes to the police and gives them this very detailed and very elaborate explanation of how his brother-in-law committed this murder with all these details that the police did not release. How in the world does that put Kenny in the picture? Where in the world would McGuire have gotten this information? Never points the finger. Kenny says Kenny did it and Kenny gave me the information. So how in the world would it be probative when you match it up against that overwhelming, detailed story that McGuire gives that he had to get from somewhere if he didn't do the murder himself?
Well, it is probative in that it tends to create reasonable doubt. And it was
you got to balance probative versus prejudicial. And if you put something in there like that that's prejudicial when you know it doesn't fit the theory at all, aren't you then steering the balance in the opposite direction against justice, against finding the truth?
Well, the best theory of the case was creating reasonable doubt that Mr. McGuire was at the crime. It was a reasonable strategy to show that someone else committed the crime here, not Mr. McGuire. And considering all the evidence he introduced, corroborating Kenny's statement that he could have possibly committed the murder, then yes, it was very probative, and to exclude the possibility of the opportunity for Mr. McGuire to present this probative evidence as to the source of the semen, to deny his right to compulsory process. There is other evidence introduced here that Kenny
So you basically believe that the defendant ought to be able to throw anything into the picture that creates reasonable doubt, even if it doesn't at all fit the theory of the case?
Well, it did fit the theory of the case, Your Honor. The theory of the case was creating reasonable doubt. And no, I don't believe that the defendant should be able to present anything whatsoever that the defendant pleases. We do have the procedural rules here, the evidentiary rules, which are designed to include probative evidence and evidence that would not confuse the jury and whatnot. Once those technical requirements of the evidence are met, to exclude it because the judge thinks it perhaps is not credible would be to invade the province of the jury.
But you agree with me that a judge has a duty under the rules of evidence to weigh prejudicial value and its relevance.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. There was other evidence in this case to show that Stewart could have committed this crime, which corroborated his statement, essentially. There was evidence of motive that Kenny and Joy Stewart were having marital problems, that Joy Stewart was smoking marijuana and cohorting with other men, and that Kenny Stewart disapproved of this behavior. Joy Stewart had also written a note to her close friend stating that Kenny had been acting weird, that she could no longer talk to him and she thought that she was losing him. Defense witness Fleeland also testified that he thought he had seen Joy Stewart the afternoon of the date of her disappearance. He thought that he saw her getting into a brown four-wheel drive pickup truck with a hitch. And Kenny owned a brown four-wheel drive pickup truck with a hitch. And true, defense witness Fleeland would have been the last person to have seen Joy alive, aside from the perpetrator of this crime. The DNA evidence indicated.
Well, was your client, do you dispute that your client was with the deceased?
According to...
On the day of the crime?
No, I don't dispute that.
Somehow the husband left work, found her when she was driving around with your client, and murdered her.
Well, the evidence presented, and this tends to be consistent with Jared Richardson's testimony, statements that Mr. McGuire has given, that Mr. McGuire had been cleaning Chris Deaton's garbage the morning of her disappearance, and that she had stopped by. Juanita Deaton, Chris Deaton's mother, had testified that she saw Joy stop by. At some point, Joy was going to get a ride from someone to go somewhere, and that she saw George Stewart talking to two men in a car. It's fairly unclear to be able to place exactly everyone's movements in a certain period of time, but the evidence has certainly been consistent that the time that Mr. McGuire saw Joy Stewart was in the morning that he was coming to the daughter, not in the afternoon.
What was it, the theory of the defense to bring in the husband having intercourse with her this way? Is it the theory that he did kill the woman, but that he didn't have or didn't rape her during the process? Is that why you wanted to enter in this possible husband having intercourse with her the night before?
Well, the reason why they wanted to enter this into evidence is that it tended to be probative on the issue of the source of the statement at the time. Now, whether or not she was raped was another issue. But this was probative as to the source of the semen, which was also probative of the identity of the murderer.
Which would eliminate the single charge of the death penalty.
Correct.
Was that your object, to eliminate that one?
Well, the object was to create reasonable doubt that Mr. McGuire was involved in any way.
At all.
That's
so
correct.
So how are you going to... I can see how you could possibly create some doubt as to whether or not the rape took place, because if you get into the evidence of the husband, you create some doubt about that. But how then would you also create doubt that your client committed a murder?
Well...
If you get in your evidence,
mm-hmm.
and create doubt as to the rape, don't you just eliminate or attempt to eliminate that element of it? But how can you eliminate by that evidence that he committed the murder?
Well, it is probative as to the identity of the murderer. instance, Joyce's body was found with semen deposited in her anus. And regardless of whether a rape took place, the person who deposited that semen around the time of the murder would have something that tends to show who the identity of the murderer is in this case.
Well, but coming back to your question, how do you, if that's your theory of defense, that theory of defense advanced, then how does one explain his knowledge of the intimate details of her demise?
Well, certainly the credibility of the conflicting testimony of the witnesses here and how one might construe, you know, in the context of Kenny Stewart possibly having committed the crime, how one might construe Dennis McGuire's statement.
How does he know about it, Kenny Stewart?
Well, he stated that Jerry Richardson told him. The issue here, though, is that he had a right to present evidence in the defense creating reasonable doubt that he was involved in the murders. And that was consistent and tended to be cooperated with other evidence tending to show that Kenny Stewart could have committed the crime here. The DNA evidence indicated that Kenny could have been a source of the semen if the evidence had been contaminated. There was evidence of contamination here.
Well, it seems to me there's a fine line between what you're advocating as propositional law and having the right to present a red herring in your defense. And that's, I think, what we're all struggling with. You don't have any rights to do that.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe that this is a red herring. I think this is far from harmless error in this case. There was not overwhelming evidence linking Mr. McGuire to the crime. Certainly no physical evidence conclusively linking him to the crime. The only physical evidence...
Well, isn't that the best defense? It's,
yeah. Well, Mr. McGuire was to present his defense, and barring any exclusion by the procedural, evidentiary rules, or the Constitution, he had a right to put this defense on. The jury deliberated 10 hours after the trial phase. That kind of indicates that the evidence was not all that clear and overwhelming. During the penalty phase, they sent a note after 4 to 5 hours of deliberation that they were consistently voting 11-1. They went on to deliberate a total of 11 and a half hours during the penalty phase. The evidence was not clear and overwhelming in this case, and with one more piece of evidence tending to show that someone else could have been the source of the semen and therefore the murderer, it could have affected the jury's decision here that there was guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And it certainly could have raised the issue of could have been a further piece of evidence going to residual doubt during this case. Now, evidence was also introduced that Kenny Stewart committed suicide in 1992, and this tended to prove that he had had a guilty conscience. This evidence of Kenny's statement was relevant to such a piece of defense, and it was made and introduced at trial under circumstances tending to indicate it was reliable. And the United States Supreme Court stated in Chambers versus Mississippi that when constitutional rights directly affecting the ascertainment of guilt are implicated, the hearsay rule may not be applied to defeat the ends of justice. In short, a court may not exclude evidence which is central to the defense, and the evidence tends to be reliable. And it sets forth certain factors to determine whether or not how to aid in this reliability determination. The first is whether the statement was made shortly after the murder. The second is whether the statement was corroborated by other evidence. Third is whether the statement was against penal interest. And the fourth is whether the declarant was available for cross-examination at the time of trial. Kenny's statement is reliable under these factors. First of all, it was made 1 week after Joy's body was found. Second, it was corroborated by other evidence. The DNA evidence introduced in this case indicated that Kenny Stewart could have been a source of the semen if the semen sample had been contaminated, and there was evidence that it was, in fact, contaminated. This evidence, the semen sample was collected in 1989.
I don't recall evidence that it was contaminated. I recall speculation that it
this and that could happen to make it contaminated, but where was the evidence that it actually was contaminated? I don't recall that.
Well, when this evidence was first sent off to the FBI for testing in 1989, they returned it to Crawford County stating it was degraded or deficient that they couldn't do any tests.
That's different from contaminated. Degraded and deficient is not equivalent to contaminated.
Well, I'm not an expert in these scientific manners, but they seem to indicate that the sample was such that they were unable to do any kind of testing, and tending to show that it was degraded, to me indicates that it was contaminated.
But I don't accept that proposition, because I think that's the evidence, but the only way that it excludes McGuire, or includes McGuire, if it is contaminated, there is no evidence that I recall that it was contaminated. There was speculation that it could be, but no evidence that it was. And the tests that were performed excluded McGuire. One test excluded McGuire. You don't dispute that unless you buy the theory that it was contaminated.
Well, if it's contaminated, you couldn't exclude any of the suspects.
Right, but if it was not,
and that's,
it does exclude McGuire. You accept that?
Yes. However, Your Honor, there was considerable evidence or testimony from defense experts stating that there was considerable opportunity here for contamination. I don't suppose anyone could conclusively know whether or not it was contaminated. However, whether it was contaminated was a matter of weight for the jury, essentially regarding this evidence.
Whatever happened to Richardson? I read this stuff, but I couldn't find anything much about Richardson, whether he was charged. When I listed it, was in there.
He was never charged.
Why not?
I don't know about that. After this evidence was returned from the FBI, it was then sent in 1992 to a California lab, and a different sample here were tested at different times. Kenny Stewart's blood sample was not even tested until 1994 here. Furthermore, there was testimony that the PCR testing used by the California lab is extremely sensitive, and that one foreign molecule, say from gloves or a plastic bag, or from someone sneezing in the vicinity could have contaminated the sample.
Counselor, I know you're in the middle of your argument, and we've derailed you. You should know that we've read the briefs pretty thoroughly and understand about not just the contamination question, but what you haven't raised is that the sample wasn't really big enough yet to even make a determination on these cases. Where I'm going with this is I'd just like you to make sure you leave enough time to talk about the penalty phase, and specifically your propositional law number 4, residual doubt, because I want to ask you a few questions about that. It's time we straighten that out, I think, once and for all. So when you get to it, it'll be fine if you do. That's what's bothering me, and I should tell you that. I mean, we know about the contamination, the evidence, and McGuire, and the husband, and all of that, and if that's important, then go ahead. But you've got another important part of this case.
Well, on that note, I'm leaving time for you.
Well, don't do that yet.
No, not yet?
No, let's talk about proposition law 4. No, you still have some time.
Okay.
I just didn't want you to waste all your time and not, because you're talking about the conviction phase or the guilt phase now. And there seems to be, let's assume there seems to be enough evidence to support the verdict of guilt. So really, your problem is the penalty phase next. And my problem with, what is the purpose of the penalty phase?
It's really stretching.
The purpose of the penalty phase is to determine.
Okay. And how do we do that? What does the statute mandate we do with regard to aggravation and mitigation?
The statute essentially tells us that the prosecution comes to prove the aggravated circumstances. They have that burden. And it has to be sent to report evidence of mitigation.
Okay, now, and the aggravation has to outweigh the mitigation in order for the death penalty to be imposed mandatorily as the statute given to us by the General Assembly requires.
Correct.
Okay. You argue in proposition law number 4, quoting quite liberally from former Justice Brown's dissent in Aponovich, that residual doubt
should be an element, and I concede that a majority of this court has said that, a residual doubt should be an element, maybe under B6 or something, in the penalty phase. What I'd like to know is, how does that become a mitigating factor? And I'll tell you why I'm concerned about it, because in this case, if I were to come to that side and accept residual doubt, I think your argument is well made. But I'm still having trouble getting over the hurdle that residual doubt, if I have residual doubt when I used to try these cases, it was my job to acquit. Now, I know some equate beyond a reasonable doubt and residual doubt as different things, but if I had any doubt in my mind with regard to the homicide, to me that was enough that who might have done it. Your job is not to convict. And I think when I was studying this again, what we've done in reviewing Justice Brown's dissent in Aponovich, he was talking really about the standard for a Rule 29 motion, legal sufficiency, which comes before maybe some of the other evidence that would come in. So what I'm wrestling with is, how does residual doubt, your argument on residual doubt, become a mitigating factor in the penalty stage to negate the sentence of death?
Well, first of all, the standard to define guilt is not beyond all doubt. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. And under the court's instructions here, and it used the same instructions for beyond a reasonable doubt that are typically used in all other capital cases, read as follows: if you are firmly convinced of the truth of the charge, the state has proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof of such character that an ordinary person would be willing to rely and act upon it in the most important of his own affairs. Now, we have argued in the past, our office, that this is similar to a clear and convincing standard, albeit without success. But the point here is, it does leave room for doubt, lingering doubt, residual doubt. As Justice Marshall has stated, a jury's verdict and truth are not unerringly synonymous. There are certain reasons why one may find that there's sufficient evidence to convict, and yet not insufficient evidence, but there tends to be lingering doubt which rules in favor of a sentence of life here.
But if you insert that into the penalty phase, you by necessity have to do it pursuant to the statute on mitigation. So we're saying that we're putting that on the scale and weighing it, that residual doubt suddenly becomes a mitigating factor to unbalance the scale. If there's residual doubt, does that not, again, go to conviction?
It may go to conviction. However, one can find beyond a reasonable doubt and convict the capital defendant. However, during the penalty phase, find that there is some lingering doubt in the circumstances of the offense. And
that's contradictory to me. And that's what I'm wrestling with. That's contradictory to me. You're conceding, as you must be the argument, I think, that it's beyond reasonable doubt the conviction. Okay. And then you're saying, when we get to the penalty phase, oh, but now I'm not sure anymore, so if I'm not as sure as I was in the guilt phase, then we shouldn't give the death penalty.
You can be sure in the guilt phase to find beyond a reasonable doubt. However, you can still have lingering doubt in wearing that standard. To find residual doubt in the penalty phase does not have to mean that to find residual doubt could mean that you have some lingering doubt, and there's room for that within the reasonable doubt standard.
Isn't it as one who's been in the majority on this and hears the issue raised frequently, isn't it that there is a difference between beyond a reasonable doubt and, as you said, absolute, beyond absolute doubt? In other words, 100% There's no doubt at all versus beyond a reasonable doubt. There's some, we don't know what it is. These are all sort of abstract terms that we create, but isn't there some space between beyond a reasonable doubt and no doubt at all about the person's guilt? And since it's a death penalty case, since we're talking about someone's life, if there is still a little doubt, beyond reasonable doubt, but still something between beyond reasonable doubt and no doubt at all, that's what residual doubt is, and that's the reason for the doctrine, is if there's any doubt, you don't put someone to death. That's the policy reason for it. At least that's my reason for it, and that was a majority at one time for it.
Well, essentially that was my argument, Your Honor, well said. And I think Lockett mandates us to consider residual doubt if, in fact, the defendant puts this forth as a piece of evidence in mitigation.
I guess what caught my attention was particularly on page 42 of your briefs, where you say, in paraphrase, indeed, no reasonable jurist should, and then you put quotes, quibble with the idea that lack of certainty of the defendant's guilt should be considered. Certainly we should consider that. And then you say Brown dissenting the site of Panovich for that provision, and I don't find that in Justice Brown's opinion at all with regard to any reasonable jurist. Would. I mean, he agrees that reasonable minds could differ with regard to that. And so when I went through it, I thought your proposition law 4 was really particularly well done on this issue, and I thought that we ought to try one more time to see, because if we have reasonable doubt, if we just say there's reasonable doubt and no other mitigation, to me that'd be enough if that's the rule. Because if there's reasonable doubt that he did it, no. If there is residual doubt that he did it, then the defendant ought to get the benefit of the statute because it has to be strictly construed against the state. So even if he wasn't a good Boy Scout and helped elderly ladies across the street and was an abused child and started on drugs at 10 and all that other stuff, if there's any residual doubt that he did it, then shouldn't that be enough to, if not acquit, at least to set aside the death penalty?
Yes, I mean, it would be enough to at least set aside.
And I think that's where you go in proposition of law 4, and that's why I was concerned about it.
Initially, I would just like to say that Lockett also requires consideration of the piece of evidence. Certainly the General Assembly had revised its section 29.29.04 sections to comply with Lockett. And B7 factor, which leaves it open to consider any other factors not listed above, means that this court should not limit the jury's consideration of a relevant factor, a factor relevant to whether or not this client or the defendant should be sentenced to death. A capital defendant is entitled to have the jury consider any of the circumstances of the event that the defendant proffers as basis for a sentence less than death. And one of those factors, which is relevant, is residual doubt. I'd like the jury any time remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard.
You.
Mr. Collier.
So
wouldn't evidence and the indication of rape was an indication of anal rape, was it not?
Actually, it was
there was some confusion as to, it's difficult to tell.
Right, I think that the board is, my executive,
perhaps the ejaculation of the anus. Now, if that's the case, would it not be relevant to the death spec for the defendant, regardless of rejecting the theory that the husband was the murderer, that to present evidence that he may have been the source of the semen?
Yes, that's it, sure. For them to present evidence that Ms. McGuire deposited semen from somewhere else, that wasn't relevant to investigation. But in order to get there, they had to produce admissible evidence of that. And that's where evidence related to 4B3 comes in. If you just have a look at that, it says that the statement at the time of its making has to so far tend to subject the defendant to criminal liability that he would not have made the statement, or a reasonable person would not have made the statement unless it's true. And that's the linchpin, I think, on this ground for relief, is how this statement at the time of its making, so far tended to subject Kenny Stewart to criminal liability that had to be true. And I think that, and I said it in the brief, I just can't see, and I'm still not convinced at all, that a husband who was asked by an investigator when was the last time he had sex with his wife, and he says, and by the way, it wasn't prior to the offense, it was somewhere along the line, 3 to 4 days before the offense. I had sex with my wife 3 to 4 days before she was murdered. How does that thing subject him to criminal liability? I still don't see it. But even if they can get by that, and they mentioned Chambers versus Mississippi, if we could go through the four liability factors there, they don't get any of the factors there. Now, Chambers versus Mississippi, what they had was Mississippi had excluded testimony that was to be offered that a person aside from Chambers, a guy named McDonald, confessed to committing crime. And in Mississippi, they had a voucher rule that prevented the defense from having called this person to impeach him with his prior confessions. And in the U.S. Supreme Court, they held that despite your voucher rule, we find a due process violation because this was reliable evidence and showed somebody else committed this crime. And they looked at the four factors they counseled out. The first factor, they said, was that in the Chambers case, that it was spontaneously made soon after the offense to an acquaintance. We have a week, I guess that's pretty soon after the offense, but it wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't to an acquaintance. It was made to an investigator who asked him the question. The second thing was the evidence corroborated? In this case, the evidence was not corroborated. There is no other evidence to show that Kenny Stewart had sex with his wife in 4 days before the murder other than Kenny Stewart's statement. And in fact, the only evidence we do have in this case about the inference, at least, that they should have dropped from this statement negates it. And there has been some discussion here about the DNA polymarker testing, and that absolutely excluded Kenny Stewart as a possible donor for the sperm that was found in the victim. Absolutely. And as Justice Stratton pointed out, even their expert found no actual evidence of contamination. He just said it could have been contaminated. So there is no evidence in this record to doubt that testing, to doubt that it was actually contaminated. So we have the fact that there's no corroboration in the statement. Third factor, the statement was very self-incriminatory. Obviously, Chambers, the guy confessed to committing a crime. Here we have a husband confessing having sex with his wife 3 or 4 days before she was murdered. I don't see how it's very self-incriminatory. And then the last one, and it's one that the Supreme Court found to be very important, was the fact that the declarant in that case was available and subject to cross-examination. The defense had called him in that case, and they found it very important that the other side had a chance to cross-examine this witness on this issue under oath. And I think one of the phrases they use, that thereby sift the conscience of the witness, and that the jury therefore was free to view this person's demeanor, see if he had a guilty conscience when he was testifying and being cross-examined. We obviously don't have that in this case, so he sort of committed suicide.
What happened to Richardson? I know that there was some argument that he couldn't have been driving the car that McGuire said he was in, but I'm just kind of curious as to why he was in charge and what the evidence was that was not against him.
Well, there really was no other evidence against him, and I didn't bring the argument as to Richardson about that. As it turns out, from the record, seeing Richardson passed a polygraph, and that was important.
Really, all the evidence against him was McGuire's statement itself.
Right.
So if McGuire did not get his detailed description of how this rape and murder occurred from Richardson, how could he have gotten McGuire from McKinney? Was that ever argued at the trial at all? Did somebody got this information from him that doesn't show up in the briefs, but did it
not help the trial? No, that was, what we were saying, another theory that was thrown out.
So they either linked it to Richardson, but they never tried to link the information that McGuire had to getting it from Alvin Kenny then?
Right.
As an issue of rape, that's an issue with treatment. McGuire's statement claimed that Richardson, or if you later confess to Thomas, he himself, somewhat raped Joy. I mean, that's what he's claiming as part of his detailed story to the police record.
Yes. And he was consistent in all the versions of that story that he told. When he told Sean Baird about it, it was a rape. When he told, I'm trying to remember from Jack Stapleton, it was more a description of the murder. And obviously, Willie Reeves was described as a rape. And the detailed statement went so far as to saying why the Bathmore Intercourse was unsuccessful and the earlier than the Formale Intercourse. So nowhere else was this described except an argument that it was something other than rape. There was conjecture that maybe they had consensual sex and they decided to kill her. That was not borne out in any of the confessions or in any of the other evidence. One other thing I just wanted to touch on in the first proposition has to do with the admissibility of this statement, the Kenny Stewart statement, in the penalty phase. And the defense has cited a couple of cases from this court discussing the applicability of the rules of evidence in the penalty phase, and this court has said that they don't strictly apply in the penalty phase. There are two cases that post-date those cases cited in which this court has explicitly said that the rules of evidence do apply in the penalty phase. They have argued elsewhere that even if the statement was inadmissible at the trial phase, counsel just had a duty to try and offer again in the penalty phase. And the state position is the rules of evidence also apply there. It was not this one of the rules of evidence, and we have none of the four chambers factors still to ensure the liability. And I guess the last thing to think about in the first proposition of law, and whether this was a statement that intended to subject him to criminal liability, the thing that I kept trying to think of, and I guess I would suggest as a test in determining whether this is the type of statement that a person would reasonably believe would subject him to criminal liability, is I see it as the type of statement that when you say it, if you said it in the presence of a police officer, that you would expect some type of action from them, an arrest, for instance. I don't see, however, any construction of the circumstances in this case that Kenny Stewart telling the investigator room off that he had sex with Victoria beforehand in his mind was so damning to him that he wouldn't have said this for true. And I would go ahead and skip to the fourth proposition of law.
Okay. As you do that, counsel, let me read you one sentence. This court should have grave doubt whether Dennis McGuire is the principal offender in this aggravated felony murder. I find that on page 51 of the appellant's brief. This court should have grave doubt whether McGuire is the principal offender in this aggravated felony murder. Assume for purposes of argument, I have grave doubt that he was the principal offender. Is it my job to vacate the sentence of death or quit?
Are you saying by grave doubt somewhere above reasonable doubt but in between absolute doubt?
I'm reading you what I had here. See, and that's the malleable, mushy sort of thing you get into. Sometimes we call it residual doubt, grave doubt, a scintilla of doubt, or other things. I just want to know, if I have grave doubt, I'm concerned just about the mechanical breakdown of the statute, once again, where this fits.
Well, I argued in a brief, page 14, footnote 2,
yes,
citing State versus Grant, that to the extent that residual doubt can be considered at all, it would be considered as the catch-all B7 mitigator.
All right, so you accept, it was alluded to as a doctrine, you accept the doctrine of residual doubt.
I accept that it exists. I still had argued by citing State versus Watson and Justice Resnick's dissent that and I think this touches on Justice O'Connor's concurrence in the case now. The residual doubt isn't something that relates to whether this individual, his character, his circumstances are such that the penalty of death is appropriate. And the way that the sentencing phase is set out, I don't see the residual doubt as a relevant mitigator. And I would stick by that argument. But Brand, even if it is applicable, and this court has said that it is a mitigator, that's the only place that it can be considered. On that side of the equation, where you balance everything, circumstances, and mitigating factors.
What would be more important under B7? The General Assembly, of course, gave us, as you say, the sort of the catch-all that court could consider any other relevant factors that would suggest the person should not be put to death. What would be a more important factor than the General Assembly did not say that you have to be convicted, a person has to be convicted beyond all doubt, right? Or by beyond any doubt. They said beyond reasonable doubt, which suggests there is still some room for doubt. The standard is a little lower than beyond absolute doubt. So now we come to the mitigation phase, and the question is whether this person is going to be put to death. What could be more important in the General Assembly's, I'm not suggesting they anticipated this, but in the language given us by the General Assembly, what could be more important in deciding whether to put somebody to death than the question of, is there still some doubt between absolute doubt being the top of the scale and reasonable doubt? There still is some room for doubt there, I think, because we've used different terms, and so there must be still some room for some doubt. Do you agree with that, or do you think that beyond a reasonable doubt really means beyond all doubt?
No, I don't believe that beyond a reasonable doubt means beyond all doubt. I think there is room there. Beyond reasonable doubt isn't, if you're going to put a number on it, 100% certain all the elements of the defense have been met. And I guess I would just go back to the argument that is not a relevant factor in mitigation. I mean, practically speaking, I think that the argument that this jury has just found him guilty of aggravated murder with this death specification, and they signed on the verdict forms, and they just found him guilty of all this, and then to turn around and say in the mitigation phase, well, maybe I'm not so sure about it. Maybe I should just give him a life sentence.
Well, maybe I'm not absolutely sure about it, because that's what the law is, isn't it? The law provides for some doubt, does it not, in the guilt phase? It provides for some doubt. Am I wrong? Beyond a reasonable doubt is not beyond absolute doubt or beyond all doubt, is it? Or beyond all doubt, beyond any doubt. We could write it that way. That could be the test. Maybe we should change it. Maybe the legislature should change the test so we don't have this. It'd be a much more difficult test, I think. But we could, I mean, that could be the law, I assume, couldn't it?
Sure, I think you could say.
But it is not, for some reason. The legislature has lowered the test for finding someone guilty, and that works for any crime except perhaps death, where it's pretty final. There's no parole, and so if there's still some doubt there between reasonable doubt and absolute doubt, what's wrong with residual doubt? What's wrong with using the policy, or whatever you want to call it, doctrine of residual doubt, and saying, well, there still is some doubt here. It doesn't mean we didn't convict the person beyond a reasonable doubt, but it means there is still some doubt. And so what's wrong with the policy that says we're not going to put that person to death? I'm not saying it applies here, but the cases where we've applied it, there aren't very many, for number one. And they are cases where there was some doubt. I mean, there was, you know, sure, they got beyond the test, but in that, whatever that percentage is, and no one knows what it is. I don't know how you just, I don't know how we define residual doubt, frankly. But it's there. It is there.
Well, I think there are two things to address. The first is the reasonable doubt standard in the penalty phase. We're not talking about necessarily reasonable doubt to commit the offense. It's whether the state proved beyond reasonable doubt the aggravating circumstance that he committed this offense while, in the course of committing a rape, outweighs the mitigation that he offered. And there are statutorily defined mitigators, and then there's the other mitigator that relates to whether he deserves a sentence to death. And I think you're right, the General Assembly could, if they wanted, put that in as a mitigator. That the B8 mitigator could be residual doubt. But I think for the reasons argued in Watson and by Justice O'Connor, I don't think that residual doubt relates to the character of the defendant and whether that defendant deserves the death penalty.
That was the issue I was trying to get at. How does it mechanically get into the penalty phase? I guess the practical answer is because there's no other place to put it.
Right.
Well, the language in 087 is pretty broad, isn't it? I mean, it says any other factors that are relevant to the issue of whether the offender should be sentenced to death. Any other factor. Well, what does that mean? I mean, it can mean a lot of things, one of which it seems to me that the sentencer, the person who has to sentence, has this degree of doubt that says to the sentencer, guilty by the standard we've set, but not I'm not sure enough that, and it's not absolute, and so not death. I mean, that's probably the only way you can get it in, it seems to me.
Right, and that's what this court said in Ramp, that if it comes in at all, it comes in under the catch-all.
Right.
Are there any other questions for this court? Should you ask this court?
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Ms. Leonard, you saved about 2 minutes of your time.
In the context of capital sentencing consideration, a possible limiting doubt must be a mitigating factor. In the juror's mind, the question as to whether or not to convict or rather to sentence a defendant to death or vote in favor of a life verdict may well come down to a matter of conscience. And if in good conscience, this juror considers the fact that there maybe have been lingering doubt as to whether or not this person should be sentenced to death, then the juror should be able to consider that as a mitigating factor. And certainly the General Assembly has provided for that in its revised code of statutes. B7 factor in 29-29-04 states that any other factors that are relevant to the issue of whether the offender should be sentenced to death. A juror's conscientious determination as to whether or not he would be able to sentence this defendant to death would be influenced, perhaps, by a lingering doubt. That juror should be able to consider that. And in section C, subsection C, the defendant shall be given great latitude in the presentation of evidence of the factors listed in subdivision B. The defendant should be given great latitude to present his theory of mitigation in the case. And one of the relevant factors of a theory of mitigation may well be lingering doubt. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinions.